We are in the Belief Project, which is our journey through the Gospel of John. So here's kind of how things are going to happen the next few weeks at City Church from a teaching perspective. We're going to do John 12 today, finish John 12 next Sunday, and then hit the pause button on the Belief Project for a few weeks. And we're going to launch a new series in 3 weeks called Flip the Script that is about the passages in the New Testament where Paul says we were one way, but now in Christ we are an entirely different way, that God flipped the script on our lives on through the cross, through the resurrection. We'll talk about it on Easter Sunday. And so we look forward to our Flip the Script series. It'll be about 5 weeks, and we'll look at some key passages, particularly in the book of Romans, on what that means. And then that'll take us all the way to Mother's Day, which is not too far around the corner. But for now, we're going to settle into John chapter 12 and work our way through this text today. And like I said, we'll finish this chapter next Sunday. So for most of you know that we have a 2.5-year-old. He just turned 2.5 this weekend, a little boy named Levi. And he's in that stage where he's fascinated with trains, okay? So I think every little boy goes through that at different times, but he's kind of in that train stage. And in his mind, the train is the choo-choo, right? The choo-choo, and then now he's got where he'll attach the word train to it, but for so long, it was just the choo-choo. And so we'll take him to see trains, and one place that he almost always sees a train or doesn't see a train is when we're driving to church and come over the bridge, coming over downtown Decatur area, there's sometimes and sometimes not a train there. And he's got where he kind of recognizes the landscape, and so he's anticipating potentially a train being there. And so he'll either say, choo-choo, train, if it's there, wow, choo-choo, train, or he'll say, uh-oh, choo-choo, which means there's no choo-choo train there, uh-oh, choo-choo, and then we'll look for a choo-choo train along the track. So he's just very fascinated with trains right now, little train sets and playing trains and all those type of things. Now, here's one thing I know about trains. Trains need two tracks to move forward with just a traditional train, right? There's no one track situations that trains ride on in just a traditional train situation. There are two tracks. I had a mentor that not too many years ago told me, Devin, you will always have two tracks in your life that will move you forward. What God has done in your life and the redemption that he has brought and your future, both of those things will always be a part of your reality, of your life. And don't ever try to get away from both of those tracks, because that is the journey that God has had you on to move you forward. We're going to be looking at that concept today at the words of Jesus in John chapter 12, because there are two tracks in life. There is kind of the track of agony, and there's the track of delight. There's the track of woe, and there's the track of kind of wonderful when things are going well in life. There's the track of anguish, and there's the track of gladness. Like, both of those tracks are a real part of our everyday lives. And I know sometimes we kind of fall into cliche Christianity or cliche living where, you know, we'll say things like, hey, I'm just going through a season right now and I'll get through this. But the reality is most of us are kind of experiencing both of those tracks of life almost all the time. But what I've discovered in my life is that when things are going really well in one area, I may be struggling in another area. If I feel like my marriage is on point, I may be struggling with my security about whatever, our finances. If I feel like things are really stable financially, I may be struggling a little bit emotionally or understanding my future. Please don't ever quote me as saying I was struggling emotionally. That doesn't sound very Devin, does it? But reality is I do that as well. And so, again, most of the time in life, we go through both of those things at the same time, whether it's relational or financial, emotional, physical, spiritual, mental. Most of the time, we are kind of facing both of those tracks at the same time. Now, based on kind of how you're wired, you will probably tend to view life from one of those perspectives more than the other. So if you're more of an optimistic person, you'll usually kind of find the good things in your life, the wonderful things, the delightful things, the gladness things. If you're more of a pessimistic person, then you'll tend to focus more on the woe track, right, and the anguish track, the difficulty track. I would say that I am more inclined that way. I would do myself justice and say that I'm a realist. That's really just a polite way of saying I'm more pessimistic in life, right? But I tend to focus more on that. For example, yesterday, Ash and I were serving at the elementary school, and part of our job was to pull weeds not just weeds, but like these clover weeds. Like even the way I'm describing this, you can see how I'm wired. Like these clover weeds that are basically impossible to get up without a backhoe. And so we are assigned to pull these weeds. And Ash, who is kind of the more delightful track person in life, her attitude is, yay, weeds. We get to pull weeds and make the flower bed look great. My attitude is, it's going to take us 9 hours to get up these clover weeds. Like I even said, I think to one person, like one of the worst parts of the curse of the Garden of Eden, I know like the whole pain and childbearing thing, but like close up on the top of the list are weeds. Like weeds came out of the sin in the garden. God cursed the ground. We're going to have to pull weeds. So we're kind of wired different ways. I'm kind of the realistic, like it's going to take us a millennia to get these weeds up. And Ash is more like, let's hurry up and get the weeds pulled so we can go in and paint the walls. And so you're going to kind of focus on one of those ways of life. Now, here, spiritually speaking, what's sometimes frustrating for the more optimistic people of life is they have verses to back it up, right? So you always run into the people that are like, we are more than conquerors. All things work together for good to those who love Jesus. His grace is sufficient for you. And I'm like, stop quoting Bible verses at me. I know up here I'm more than a conqueror, but right now I got to pull weeds. We are reminded in our text today what the church has historically embraced about Jesus, and that is this, that he was fully God and fully human. What that means about Jesus in our text today, what that means is that he went through the same sentiments, the same reactions, the same emotions that we face. Now, let me bring us back up to speed with our context. We're in the last week of Jesus' life. The cross is rapidly approaching. He said last week, his hour has come. After saying over and over again in John's gospel, my time has not come. Last week, the transition happens where Jesus says, my hour has come. And then he invites his hearers to come to follow him and to die, right? To die is what it means to follow him. But before Jesus' invitation for us to die, he will suffer and die. He must bear the sin of the world. He must be separated from his Father. He must endure the wrath of God on the cross. And when we arrive in our text, Jesus is feeling the weight of that. He's feeling the weight of this pending event that we call the crucifixion. Now, John's gospel is unlike the other three gospel writers. John does not give us the account of what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane. You may remember that, where Jesus took his followers for the final night before the crucifixion. They go into the garden. Jesus goes to pray, and his prayer to the Father was, Father, allow this cup to pass from me. Like, we feel his anguish, we feel his pain in that moment. Then the rest of his prayer obviously is not my will, but yours be done. But in our text today, John does give us that same thing. He provides us a glimpse into the anguish of Jesus in his final day. So let's pick up in verse 27 is where we left off last week in verse 26. So just the opening phrase of verse 27, this is Jesus speaking. Jesus says, now is my soul troubled. Now is my soul troubled. Now that word troubled, it's a very strong word. It carries the idea of being in shock. Like, I'm in shock of what's going on right now. It carries the idea of being deeply distraught, of being in complete and utter anguish in your life. And so that word troubled is a deep word. It's a soul word. And what we see here is Jesus struggling with the weight of what is about to happen to him. The weight of bearing the sin of the world. Now, this is a very natural response in times of crisis and trouble, that the path of suffering is not easy for Jesus in this text. He's human. We see him in his full humanity here as his agony is fully revealed. And we realize that anguish is a part of life, isn't it? Like, both of those tracks are a reality in your life. That anguish is a part of the journey of life that you've heard me say before, and I'll say it again, that you're probably in one of three places in your life. You're either coming out of some kind of trial, you're in the middle of one, or you're about to face one. Like, that's our reality of life. We are either in one of those kind of seasons that we are coming out of a trial, we are in the middle of a trial, or we're about to face one on the horizon, that difficulties and uncertainty and pain and suffering are a part of real life. And this track of uncertainty and anguish and pain and suffering, this track of life makes our hearts heavy. It troubles our soul. Some of you are facing that today. Some of you are facing the track of woe in your life. Emotional woes you may be going through right now. Some of you are facing physical woes, physical difficulties in your life right now. Some of you are going through some extreme relational woes in your life. Some of you are having a spiritual crisis in your life right now. You've got a lot of doubts and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of what ifs. And if God really exists, like, why am I not connecting to Him? And you're just going through that spiritual woe of life. Some of you are going through financial difficulties right now. And as Jesus portrays in this text, it's like, you don't want to be in that place. Your heart's heavy. Your soul is troubled. And you don't want to be there. My soul is heavy. My soul is troubled. Can I tell you this today? Jesus gets that. Like, He understands it. We see it in the text. He empathizes with us. We read it in our call to worship this morning, that He identifies with us, that Jesus experienced what it means to have a troubled soul, a heavy heart. Our call to worship reminds us that He was not removed from those experiences, but instead He endured them in order to identify with us. You know what that tells me? Listen, it is not a sin to have a heavy heart. It's not wrong to have a heavy soul, to feel the weight of what's going on in your life. Like, Jesus sympathizes with that. Jesus gets it. Jesus went through it. I mean, here He is on the brink of facing the cross, and we hear the words of Jesus as He cries out to His Father, "My soul's heavy. My soul is troubled. My soul is in a place of difficulty." And as we watch Jesus in this situation, He exposes us to the God-honoring way to face these very real moments of life. So I want to unpack briefly the response of Jesus in this text with just a series of questions. Questions to ask ourselves when we are on the track of anguish and that track seems very overwhelming in life. So let's kind of work our way through the text with these key questions. The first question that we kind of draw from how Jesus dealt with this is this question: what is God's will for me in this moment? What is God's design? What is God's will for me in this moment? As I'm traversing the track of anguish and difficulty and woe and uncertainty, what is God's will for me in this moment? Look what the rest of verse 27. Jesus says, "What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour." And so the shadow of the cross is lurking over Jesus, and His soul is heavy. And we hear Him wrestling with His humanity. We hear Him wrestling with God's plan. And we read the words, "What shall I say? Shall I ask God to save me from this hour?" And there's an implied answer there. The implied answer is no. No, because the rest of Jesus' words is for this very purpose that I've come. So He's wrestling. His soul is heavy. His response is, what should I do in this hour? Should I ask God to save me from this? And He says, no, this is for the very purpose that I have come. So what Jesus displays here is both the horror of His struggle of what awaits Him and at the same time His absolute commitment to God's will. His genuine anguish of the soul and yet the strength of His obedience. You see, in His most difficult hour, Jesus chooses His next step of obedience. He chooses God's plan. He chooses God's will. So when your heart is heavy, when your soul is troubled, ask yourself, what is God's will for me in this moment? What is my next step of obedience in this moment? As I'm going through this, as I'm feeling the weight of the track of anguish and uncertainty and difficulty and whatever struggle that is, financial, relational, spiritual, emotional, physical, as I'm going and I'm feeling the weight, right? I'm riding on this side of the track right now. As I'm feeling that, the question is, what is God's design? What is God's next step of obedience for me? You see, here's what I know. God is in control of the end game. God's in control of the big picture. And God can be trusted. And so what I've got to ask myself is, what is God's will for me in this moment? What is my next step of obedience? As my marriage is struggling right now, as I'm unsure of whether things are going to work out, like as I'm riding that track, as I'm going through that difficulty, what's my next step? What can I do right now? What is my next step of obedience? Not what's our marriage going to look like in 10 years. Not how are we ever going to get through this. The question you ask yourself is, what is God's will for me right now? What is my next step of obedience in this moment? That's where Jesus was. As the cross is lurking over him, as he's wrestling with this in the garden, right, in particular, like, God, I feel the weight of this, but it's not my will that's going to be done. It's your will. What's my next step of obedience? So as you're going through the difficulties in marriage, what about grief? Like, that's a big one, right? Like, as we go through grief, some of you have had your heart broken or you've lost someone and you're going through grief and you don't know, how am I going to get through this? How's this next season of my life going to look? I don't know how to go forward without this person in my life. Like, take the next step of obedience. In my uncertainty, what does my future look like? Like, where's my career going to end up? Like, ask yourselves those immediate questions. What do I do right now? Now, let me give you some assurance here. The answer may not be figure it out. The answer may not be scramble and make the pieces come together and get all the stars aligned and figure it out. That may not be the answer. Your answer may be wait. As we sang this morning, wait and pray and trust. That may be your next step of obedience. That may be your next step in the moment, is to wait on God and to trust and to rest in who he is. It may not be, how's our marriage going to end up healthy in 5 years? I don't know how we're going to get there based on what's happening right now. It may not be, hey, get your career path set so you know your future and your retirement settled. It may not be that. It may be right now in this moment, I'm just going to wait, because growth happens in the waiting. And my next step of obedience may just be trusting God right now. Because I can only see like what's right in front of me. So I'm just going to trust God right now. So as you're riding the track of anguish and difficulty and struggle, what is God's will for me in this moment? In this moment, what's my next step of obedience? Now, here's something else we see displayed through Jesus. It's an important question here. How can God's name be glorified through this moment? In this moment, how can God be glorified? How can God's name be glorified? Look what Jesus says in 28. Father, glorify your name. He's wrestling. He's struggling. My soul is heavy. My soul is troubled. Father, glorify your name. And then this voice comes from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The weight of what Jesus is facing is overshadowed by his ultimate desire. And his ultimate desire is for the name of God to be glorified in this event. You see, for Jesus, the Father will be glorified through what is about to happen on the cross. It is on the cross that his ultimate glory will come through the obedience and sacrifice as his Son. And we see that emphasized by the voice of the Father speaking from heaven. Jesus says, Father, glorify your name. And the Father responds only one of three times in the life of Jesus that we hear, see God speaking, like verbally. This is one of the three. And in this instance, God's like, I will glorify my name. It will be glorified. Now, what's about to happen? What's about to happen is Jesus is about to die. The glory of God will be displayed, fully displayed, through the suffering of the Son, through Jesus, who has died and raised back to life. So here's the key here. God's glory is often most clearly seen through our suffering, because it is in our suffering that his strength is most evident. By leaning into Jesus, by exercising faith and trust during the most difficult times, it is then that we mirror Jesus and God is glorified. Like, we get this. Like, we have dealt with people that they're going through stuff and you don't know how they're getting through it. And you talk to them and all they're doing is like pushing you toward God, pushing you toward Jesus. Like, I don't understand it. I don't know what I'm going through right now, but God's going to be magnified. God's going to be glorified. God's teaching me this. And you're scratching your head like, I don't get like how you're acting that way, or that's your attitude when you're going through this. And the reason is because in our times of suffering is when God is most glorified, because it's when we lean into him and rest in him, and it's through his glory, it's through our suffering that his glory is made manifest. Now, I want to give you a word of warning here. This is so important to grasp, and I don't want to miss it from this text. And the word of warning is this, like, don't allow your moments of suffering to turn your focus inward. That is most often what happens. We're going through stuff, we're suffering, and our eyes get turned to us. And we kind of fall into this kind of woe is me mentality. Like, look what I'm going through. Look at the pain I'm going through. Look at the suffering. And suffering becomes selfish. And here's how you'll hear people try to make people feel better that emphasizes that. You'll hear things like this. You do whatever makes you feel better in the moment. You know what that really is doing? It's like, turn your eyes inward. Like, your suffering makes it become selfish. So here's what I want to say to you today. Suffering is a battleground. It is a battleground. It is a battleground that pushes us either toward Jesus or away from Jesus. And it is in the response of Jesus in our text and the words of the Father echoing from heaven that reminds us that in our moments of deepest anguish, that God is in absolute control, and that God, that the glory of God is my ultimate good. Is your soul troubled? If so, ask, how can I bring glory to God's name through this? How can my suffering be an instrument to point people to God's purposes, to God's name? How can my difficulty, how can my anguish point to the greatness of God, the goodness of God? Difficult question. Tough struggle. But in your moment, you're going to be pushed toward Jesus or pushed away from him. How can I, in this moment, magnify the name of God? When it doesn't make sense, how can I push people to Jesus? How can I lean into Jesus? So, key questions. All right, here's the next one that Jesus shows evidence of in this text. Here's the question. What bigger plan is God working in this moment? In this moment, riding this track of life, the anguish track, the woe track, the difficulty track. What bigger plan is God working in this moment? Look at the response of the crowd and what kind of unfolds here. Verse 29. The crowd that stood there, they heard it, meaning the voice of God, said that it had thundered. The other said, an angel has spoken to him. But Jesus answered, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show them by what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? So God speaks, and the crowd says, man, must be coming up a storm. I heard some thunder outside. They must have lived in the south where there's thunderstorms that come up and you hear them long before you see them. But either way, they're like, hey, is there thunder going on? And someone said, man, that must have been an angel. And then Jesus said, look, the Father spoke, but this is taking place for your sake, not for mine. God is setting a bigger motion in place, a bigger plan in place. God is setting in motion this redemptive plan. And then he kind of gives us this overview of it. First thing he says is that judgment is being initiated. You saw that in 31. Now is the judgment of this world. We often think in terms of judgment as the end of time. But Jesus says here that through the cross event, that judgment is initiated. The murder of Jesus unmasks those who are in opposition to God. It reveals, it brings to light the depth of our sin. That we as sinful humans could crucify the Son of God. The perfect, sinless Son of God. The crucifixion reveals the depth of our depravity. And judgment is pronounced on those who refuse to believe in Jesus, to embrace Jesus as the one who came to bring life. John already said it back in chapter 3 when we were looking at the story of Nicodemus. He says, you're born into this world condemned already. That judgment is already placed upon those who are sinners. But notice Jesus also says, not only is judgment initiated, again, think about this in terms of God's big redemptive plan. Judgment is initiated, and also Satan is defeated. The end of verse 31, the ruler of this world will be cast out. The cross and the resurrection of Jesus achieved the guaranteed victory of God over Satan. So what looked like a potential defeat, the death of Jesus, right? I mean, when Jesus died, you had to think that Satan was like, woohoo, I win, you lose. But he didn't know the rest of the story, did he? Like 3 days later, he's getting up, dude. But in that moment, it looked like Jesus was defeated. But what looked like a potential defeat in the crucifixion is in fact the evidence of God's ultimate triumph over evil, over sin, over Satan. That God was unfolding this bigger redemptive plan. And again, Jesus has given us a snapshot. Judgment is initiated, Satan is defeated, and people are drawn to Christ. 32 and 33 again. When I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show them by what kind of death he was going to die. So people are drawn. As Jesus is lifted up, and this is both literally on a cross and symbolically, ultimately in his exaltation, people are drawn to Jesus. That all people without distinction are invited into God's family. Now, anytime we hear this language, particularly in John's gospel of Jesus being lifted up, is an Old Testament reference here back to the book of Numbers, which is probably not a book that you spend a lot of time in Bible study in. But in the book of Numbers, there's this fascinating story as the people of Israel are traveling through the desert, traversing through the desert, and they're all ticked off about being there. And we wish we were back in Egypt, and all the things that they said. And they get God, you know, God sends his judgment on them. One way that God sends his judgment in the middle of all that time is he sends venomous snakes, poisonous snakes. Now, there's not very many people in this room that would appreciate that. There is one, but he says every time I mention snakes, I call him by name. So I'm not going to call him by name today, Eric. The dude has venomous snakes in his living room in a glass cage. I'm just saying there's not something not right about that. But in Numbers 21, venomous snakes are sent among the people of God as judgment. And they start striking the people. And so God says to Moses, like, the way out of this is, like, create a bronze serpent, hold that thing up on a pole, and everyone that looks to the serpent will be healed. They will live. Look and live. Lift up the bronze serpent, and the people who have been struck by the venomous snakes who are dying, when they look on the symbol, when they look on the sin bearer, they will live. And so when John uses the language of Jesus being lifted up on a cross, that's the symbolism he's referring back to. That there is a reality that each of us have been struck by the venomous, poisonous curse of death, and we are dying. We are dying physically, we are dying spiritually, and the cry of the gospel is, look to the bearer of sin. Look to Jesus, who will be lifted up. And if you will look to him, you will live. Look and live. Look and have life. And that's the reference here. Jesus says, I'm suffering. My soul is troubled. But God is doing something that's bigger. There's a redemptive plan in place. And in that redemptive plan, judgment is initiated. right? Satan is defeated, and people are drawn without distinction to the gospel. Look and live to the bearer of sin. Now, in our text, the people fail to get this. They fail to grasp the bigger picture because of what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, this misunderstanding of who the Messiah was. And we see their words here, like, the Messiah can't die. Like, we have this picture of who the Messiah is, and death's not a part of the equation. Like, they missed it. But God was at work, and the suffering of Jesus was a part of his divine plan. Here's how I want to encourage you today. As you're riding that track of anguish and defeat, don't forget that God is working a bigger, redemptive, not just a plan, a redemptive plan that we may or may not be able to see. And if you're a follower of Jesus, it is because of his plan. Let's go back to our text here. It is because of his plan you are not condemned. You are not condemned. Judgment has been initiated by the cross of Jesus. But if you're a follower of Jesus, that judgment doesn't fall on you. You are not condemned, Paul says in Romans. The judgment has been initiated by the cross, but it is the cross that sets us free from the judgment that was initiated. So listen to me, follower of Jesus. There is a redemptive plan at work, and you are not condemned. Also, hear this. The enemy, Satan, he has no claim on you. He has no authority over you. He was defeated on the cross. Now, he's got authority and claim over those who are not following Jesus. He's in absolute control of their lives, and they are destined to a devil's hell outside of Jesus. But in Jesus, in the cross, the enemy is defeated. And those who look and live, those who put their faith in Jesus through the cross, who are drawn by the Holy Spirit, he has no stake in your life. He has no claim over you. Live like a person of victory, not like a person of defeat. The redemptive plan of God has been put in place. But there's a third thing we mentioned, right? People are drawn. You're not condemned. Satan has no claim on you. And guess what? You are secure in Jesus. As you are riding the difficulty of life, as you are riding on the track of pain and anguish, and your heart is troubled and your sorrow is real, remember today, you are not condemned. You are not condemned. Satan has no claim on you, and you are secure in Jesus. The redemptive plan is at work. I love Paul's words when he says this, that God is restoring all things. He is making all things new. You know what that means? That whatever sin is taken from you, whatever death has entered into your life, whatever sorrow has happened, whatever that havoc that the enemy has caused in your life, that God is working a redemptive plan that will restore all those things, that will make all things new. That there is coming a day where the enemy's authority, where his rule is cut off, it's eliminated, and God is restoring all things. We are looking forward to that day in anticipation. But I want to encourage you, there's a redemptive plan at work. Keep your eyes on the bigger picture in the moment. What redemptive plan is God working in this moment? All right, here's our last question. We're done today. Last question. How do I chase the light in this moment? In this moment, how do I chase the light? Look at 35, 36. Jesus said to them, "The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he's going. While you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of light." Jesus brings back one of his favorite analogies here, light and darkness. And in summary, what he's saying is, when you feel like the darkness is going to overtake your soul, chase the light. Chase the light. Walk in the light. Stay close to the light. Don't lose sight of the light. Pursue the light. Keep your eyes on the light. Now, the darkness is overpowering, isn't it? The darkness can be overpowering. It can be overtaking. It will overtake you if you allow it. You can't see in the dark. You know what happens in the dark? You stumble. You fall. You run into stuff. eventually, in the dark, spiritually speaking, we die. So what do? We chase the light. Here's what I know. As you are riding the track of life, the anguish track, the difficulty track, if you are not chasing the light, if you are focused on the darkness, you know what? You're going to want to quit. The darkness to a heavy soul will make you want to quit, to throw in the towel, to give up, to settle down in the darkness and just exist there. So when the darkness lurks, don't walk away from the light. Remain in the light, because it is only by the light that we are able to see out of the darkness. Now, we get this concept even, you know, just the way we think in humans. If I put us in a dark cave with no light and I give us one flashlight or one torch that's lit, right, with one flame, you better stay close to the light or you're not going to see. You're going to stumble and you're going to fall. As a matter of fact, if there is a group of us, right, we're all going to huddle and stay close to that light and stay close to each other because we don't know what's lurking out there. So you're going to stay close to the light. If we're in the cave and you've got the light, I'm staying close to you so I can see my way out. Same imagery here. Some of you are in the darkness today. Your soul is troubled. There is a cave of darkness on your heart, and you are tempted to drift away from the light. You are tempted to allow the darkness to overwhelm you. You are tempted to allow the darkness to push you away from Jesus instead of toward the light. And I want to encourage you today, when you are in the dark, chase the light. Chase the light. Chase what you can see. Chase the truth. Stay close to the light of God. So, here's how I'm going to end. Troubled soul, heavy heart, Jesus understands. He empathizes. He gets it. So what do? We follow the pattern of Jesus. What is God's will for me in this moment? What is my next step of obedience? What is my next immediate step of obedience? Troubled soul, how can God's name be glorified in this moment? How can I make much of Jesus even when I don't feel like it? How can I magnify God's name even when my soul is heavy? Troubled soul, what bigger redemptive plan is God working in this moment? What's he salvaging? What's he restoring? What's he making new? Focus on it, right? You are not condemned. Satan has no claim on you. You are secure in Jesus. What bigger plan is God working? What redemptive plan is God working in your heart in this moment? And then the last one, troubled soul, how do I chase the light in the moment of darkness? Stay close to it. Stay close to the light. Cling to Jesus. Hold on to Jesus. There's something encouraging to me as a follower of Jesus to know that as Jesus was facing his pending crucifixion, that in the honesty and integrity and humanity of his heart, he cries out, "My soul is troubled. My heart is heavy. But not my will, but yours be done." And it is in his strength, it is in his obedience, it is in his faithfulness that I can look to him, that my eyes can be on him. Because here's what I know. When you're not strong enough, when you don't feel strong enough, he is. We don't feel like I can be faithful in this moment. Guess what? He is faithful. When you step out of the light into the darkness, guess what? He is faithful. He's working a redemptive plan to bring you back, to draw you near, to work in your life to bring him closer to you. Stay close to Jesus. Cling to him when your soul is heavy. Lean into his obedience, his faithfulness. Chase the light.